Natural Resources to order. And since the famous, illustrious Senator Jason Atkinson is sitting directly in front of me, we're going to rearrange things a little bit and have a public hearing and a possible work session on his Senate Bill 748. And I'll ask Judith if she will to try and wake the rest of us up and get us going this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 748 directs the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to create a pilot program for the collection, recycling, and proper disposal of fishing tackle. The measure would sunset January 2nd, 2008. We have received a no revenue impact on the measure. We will have a potential fiscal impact due to the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Well, I'm sure that people have just been waiting for us to tackle this issue.
I'm not calling for that.
And with that, I'm going to ask Senator Atkinson if he'd like to step forward.
Is there a staff measure somewhere in that one?
Is there a staff measure 78.7?
No.
Thank you, committee. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator, District 2, Jackson, Josephine Counties. Before you, Senate Bill 748, which is a pilot program, which I'll explain in just a moment why it's a pilot program. But what this seeks to do is to clean up various types of tackle that are littering many of Oregon's rivers. I first came across a program similar to this when I was in Alaska on a very popular river, of which I hiked down the middle of this river from wilderness area down to an area that was congested with just thousands of tourists lining shoulder to shoulder. The bottom of this river, there was a volunteer cleanup that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game had set up with conservation groups to recycle leader and lead. And it was intriguing because this box was not a waste can or a trash can. It was this actual small little box that was up on a pole or a post that had a sign that said, you know, here in Alaska we're going to clean this stuff up. And just by curiosity, for the rest of my time, I kept looking in that box to see if it would work. I mean, to see if people were actually taking advantage, which it was always full. Well, it led to me calling up to Alaska to see a little bit more background of why they thought it was important to do it, but more importantly, why it was working. Why wouldn't somebody just naturally throw this stuff away? Which led to the bill today. The reason that they said was that it was just a heightened awareness that this stuff needs to get out of rivers, and what happens most often is people will clip this stuff or ball this stuff and they just lay it there, or it either breaks off in the river or it for some reason stays on the bank. And by heightening people's awareness, or what I would hopefully like to see, people's changing conservation ethic, they would just deposit it. So this bill before you seeks to set up a pilot program on six rivers, two of which are named in the bill, for the very purpose of starting a public-private partnership between the agency, ODF&W, and various conservation groups to try this and to essentially set up a similar system of recycling or of disposing of this material, either at popular put-ins for boats or takeouts or popular established fishing areas. I've listed one river in my district, the Rogue River, and another one up here of which I'm very familiar, the North Santa Am. And at one time I had all the other rivers listed, but working with the agency I decided to leave some flexibility. The reason those two are identified is because I know there's active conservation groups that would pick up the mantle essentially and see if we couldn't get this to be a success. Secondarily, the reason why there's only six listed is because I don't want it to be so statewide that it would never get to any reasonable amount of success. I thought if we have a pilot program and make it grow, we'd make it grow. I've always said that if you were to drain the Rogue River for one day and look at the bottom of it, you'd probably find all kinds of material that we probably wouldn't want down there. About 20 years ago, there was a national trend in wetland areas to get rid of lead, lead shot, and to move to steel. And some of that's being talked about on rivers, but I hopefully would suggest that this would be more of a proactive approach to get rid of it. Before you is an article that I found that mentioned this incidentally after I'd already written the bill, and so I've made a copy of it for you. But you will notice there's this, on that article there's something called fluorocarbon. The interesting thing about this new technology is it doesn't disintegrate. Once it's there, it's there. So while I have never used this stuff, I know that we would certainly not like to have it littering Oregon's rivers. A couple of asides before I answer questions. One of which was I was a little, I don't really know why this would be needed to be sent to Ways and Means, and I would ask humbly that the subsequent referral would be taken off. I did my very best effort to make sure that it would have no fiscal impact. And in so doing, I might note, I don't know if the groups are here today, but I have met with groups ranging from the Audubon Society, Oregon Anglers, Oregon Guides and Packers, Oregon Trout. Who else have I met? Various groups, and also met with the agency to put this together. The agency, hopefully they'll testify about some success they've recently had, public-private partnerships, on the Sandy River. And so I'm just trying to build on that enthusiasm and get some success. The last note I will say, and that is, before I introduce the measure, I did kind of a survey of people that I'm with frequently on rivers, a informal survey with a very small, unscientific sampling size. But I asked everyone, where do you put this stuff? I know where I put it when I clip off a little piece of bad mono or a piece of tippet. And unanimously, everybody puts it down their waders. And at the end of the day, empties this stuff out and throws it away. So while there is some of the ethic that I think we would like to promote in Oregon, hopefully this will spread across Oregon. That's the intent of it, and if I can answer any questions, I'm happy to do so.
Going to go from waiter stuffing to whatever we're going to do late this afternoon.
Do you have a question?
It's going to be a very tough day for me.
Does anybody have a question? The good senator.
You know,
from Jacksonville.
Include the Rogue River. Isn't that river like already sort of trashed and gone anyway?
I think we can ignore the senator in my far left.
I really hope that Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really hope this takes off. I really do. It works really well in Alaska. And I think there's similar pushes in Montana. But I know here in Oregon, we have some rivers that are just extremely popular, which is wonderful. But every one of those, if you walk up and down the sides of those rivers, you will find this stuff all laying all over the place.
Yeah.
Now, rather than having a fine or having something where ODF&W's got to go out and police or, you know, making it difficult, I'd like to see if we can't change the ethic or at least heighten the awareness of this problem and get it fixed on a voluntary basis.
I can understand the problem of lead, but I don't know anything about the fluorocarbon. Do you know what that's referring to in the article that we haven't yet read?
It's like monofilament. Monofilament is fishing line.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes when it kinks up or it balls up, people just either leave it or birds will make a nest out of it. And I think there's a disgusting picture of an osprey caught in it. Monofilament over time will break down, like 10 to 15 years, I'm told. This new stuff, which is supposed to be stronger than monofilament, doesn't break down. So that's, I think, what the article's talking about.
Okay. Any other questions? Sounds like a good bill. Thank you for bringing it by this morning. I'm going to ask Kay Brown from ODF&W if she'll come up and share wisdom with us on this Monday morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kay Brown, representing the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I apologize, I don't have prepared testimony for you, but I would like to let you know that we do support the bill, but do have some concerns about it. The department certainly supports clean rivers, and we recognize that trash is, in general, needs to be addressed. There are no programs currently in Oregon that specifically address fishing tackle recycling other than the Berkeley line recycling program that allows fishermen to turn line into some of the sporting goods stores, and then that's shipped off to Berkeley. But there are a variety of programs throughout the state that address trash, including the Adopt a River program through state parks, Solve, as well as many of the community programs, volunteer programs, and those sorts of things. And we would expect that we could enlist those kinds of programs in a volunteer program and a pilot program like this that would help with the cleanup efforts. Where we have a concern primarily is that this bill speaks to not only monofilament line and leader, but also lead weights and lures. And what we're concerned about is if there are some sort of recycling bins that we end up with garbage in those bins, and then someone has to sort all of that out, and that can be quite an issue. So we would like to see the bill limited to lines rather than just than the whole cadre of fishing gear.
How would that address the problem? Because if somebody wants to use it as a trash can, they're going to, whether it's a trash can just for the lines or whether it's a trash can for the lead and the lines both. I don't understand the difference.
My understanding is that some of these recycling bins can be designed so that they limit somewhat the amount of trash that goes into those. My understanding is that with the Alaska program, they have done that, and they've been fairly successful in keeping most of the trash out, whereas if you have a larger bin that everybody just throws things into, you end up with a trash container. So our position would be that it would be helpful if it were limited to just that, and certainly, you know, with a pilot program we could try that to start with, and then expand it if that was successful. We do have some successes, as was mentioned, in terms of volunteer programs now that are collecting those kinds of things. What this would do is actually recycle that line as opposed to picking it up and putting it into trash bins. So we would support the recycling component of the bill.
Don't they recycle lead somehow?
Most fishermen recycle lead. I mean, that's something that they will do on their own generally. So we don't see that as much of a problem in terms of lead in areas that people don't pick up.
Okay.
We appreciate the notion of putting it into a pilot program as trying to put into a larger program throughout the state. It'll give us a chance to look at some of those areas. In particular, what we'd like to look at is those areas that you know, start the program looking at high angler use areas or areas where there's a department presence, such as those areas where we're doing creel surveys now. That will help limit the fiscal impact on the agency itself. We don't see it as a huge fiscal impact, other than someone will have to manage the program in some way, and in terms of getting information out to volunteer groups, and also in terms of preparing the report that would have to come back to the legislature. But other than that, we don't see it as a large demand on the agency staff.
Okay.
Okay, and that's the end of my comments.
Questions.
Happy to answer any
questions.
Anybody
have any questions? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What other four rivers would the department likely choose?
Well, we're looking at a number of them. One would be the Schutz River around the Shears Fall areas. Another would be the Alsea River, probably near Alsea. Fish Hatchery would be a good collection site because there's a lot of anglers in that area. Salmon River around Salmon River Hatch could be another one. Sandy River was mentioned. North Fork Nehalem, we have a hatchery right there, so it would be fairly simple to provide a collection site at that location. Grand Ron River might be another one. We have a Troy Wildlife Area would be a possibility. Those are the ones that we're thinking of at this point would be potential sites.
And the North Umpqua, of course. You wouldn't forget the North Umpqua.
The North Umpqua is not on my list, but certainly there are areas where...
I thought I heard her say North Umpqua.
Did I miss one? I apologize.
Thank you very much, Kenny.
You bet.
Wait a minute. I just thought of a question. Had you discussed this with your concern with Senator Atkinson?
I have not specifically. Roy Elker, the deputy of the department, has been working with Senator Atkinson on the bill, and Senator Atkinson has modified the bill significantly over time because of some of the concerns that we raised, so we really appreciate that. This last one, because the bill came out fairly soon, you know, recently, and I didn't have a chance to share that with a lot of the other members of the department, I've not had a chance to talk with Senator Atkinson.
Okay. Well, give the senator a chance to react in a few minutes, too.
Maybe we could amend this into the porta potty bill. Never mind.
That's not in my committees. I hear that.
It's all recycling, relating to recycling.
That's in your bill someplace, or in your committee somewhere. Thank you very much. Phil Donovan is on my list next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Members of the committee, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. Our board had an opportunity to consider this legislation when it was still in LC form and has voted to endorse this bill. It dovetail really nicely with a lot of work that we're already doing out in the field. What's being distributed to you right now is a public service announcement that is being printed in our quarterly newsletter. The issue of fluorocarbon line and its ability or lack of ability to disintegrate in the water by its very nature, it's designed to be very durable, it's become an increasing problem. Birds getting trapped in this line, mangling feet and whatnot, not to mention just being a tripping hazard out in the waterways. This public service announcement was put together, and frankly, we've got it a little bit on hold right now because we want to see how this legislation turns out, because we would want to go out and stump for its support by everyday anglers. When I said that it dovetails nicely with some of our ongoing work, what I'm referring to is that we have chapters that are located around the state, and one of the things they do is that they create door prizes at their chapter meetings for people who bring in this line and get it recycled through the Berkeley program that's done in conjunction with G.I. Joe's. Some of the rivers that we think would make for a good opportunity for this legislation would be the South Santa Yam, the Trask, the Sandy River, and the McKenzie. Not to digress too far from where ODF&W is, but these are four waterways that have strong chapters of Northwest Steelheaders who would be interested in being a part of this pilot program. When we talked about it, the vision would be not necessarily trash cans, Senator Shields, but rather small, probably steel or wood boxes that have a narrow slit on top where, you know, you can keep the coffee cups from being put in there, but you can put this type of fishing line, maybe even the BBs and lead shots that are a part, you know, that are attached to this used equipment. So
is that your response to Kay's? Which way would you go on that? What Kay was driving at?
Truthfully, what was Kay driving at?
Kay was wanting to just recycle the line and not the lead. That's what I'm saying.
Well, okay. Appreciate the clarification, Mr. Chair. We think that in all likelihood, when people utilize the line, they're clipping small BB shots and whatnot onto this line. You're probably going to get a lot of that back through this program, and we can, you know, deal with that to the best that we can.
Okay.
So I don't particularly envision that being a huge problem. And frankly, I think if you put these boxes up, you're going to get that sort of material coming back, and we should plan for that.
Okay. Any questions? Any other comments you'd like to make?
Appreciate the
What
time.
Do you think the reaction of fishermen would be if you just simply labeled these, you know, for recycling of line and shot or whatever only? Do you think they'd respond, or are they still going to try and stuff their coffee cups and other garbage in there?
Again, I think that the design of the box is going to be pretty important, too, whether or not they can do that. But, okay. You know, for the most part, anglers are good stewards of the resource, and I think we can generally count on them to do the right thing.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Atkinson, would you like to respond to the issue that Kay Brown raised. And Roy, did you want to come up and weigh in on this or not? That's okay. I'm sure the senator can defend himself.
We generally support the bill. And this committee, Roy Elliker, for the record, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chair, the department supports this bill. We generally support the bill. If the committee passes the bill out as is, we will not have a problem with it. We did want to go on the record, though, however, and lay out the one issue, which was, from my understanding of other states that do this, the key is to limit it, to really hone in on the line, the monofilament line recycling. But, I mean, if the bill passes this, we can handle it. It's a pilot program. I don't think there'll be any financial impact, because my sense would be that it'll be run through our STEP bios, coordinating with the volunteer groups and STEP groups. So we think it's a pilot program. We can go with this right now.
Okay.
Sure.
Yes. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Roy, Kay said that the report is another thing to put the fiscal on it, a potential fiscal on a bill. How much is the report going to be, the report back to the next legislative session?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Beyer, I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Subsection 4 of the bill is the department shall report to the 73rd Legislative Assembly on the...
I can't even say that word.
The efficacy, sir.
Efficacy.
Efficacy.
Of the program established. How much is that report? I mean, I think that's the issue of a fiscal, is that report.
How much would a report like that cost, for instance?
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not thinking it would cost very much. I'm thinking, actually, we could probably work with a couple of the larger groups like Northwest Steelheaders and help them draft a report with us. So we're not preparing a huge report here. It's a pilot project, a simple report saying whether the program has worked, is working in the areas we've tried or not. It's a pretty simple deal. I'm not looking for a large fiscal impact just by sake of a report, sir.
Thank you.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you.
Comments?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jason Atkinson again. Four quick points. First point is, I talked to the largest larger tackle manufacturers in Hood River who found this bill somewhere filed and had to call me in their support. So I talked with Lur Jensen, who was very happy about the bill as written, not only for the leader portion of it, but also the tackle portion of it. Number two, we specifically did not put any dimensions upon how a box would be built, because that would probably be the responsibility of conservation groups in order to keep the fiscal down, who might have different ideas. And I don't think that, while many of us are so intrigued by building codes as a policy discussion, I thought we could keep leader recycling boxes out of that type of government policy.
Some people
have done tubes. They've put a big tube, like a long PVC tube, that things were able to be recycled in, or, as Phil suggested, a metal box. There's going to be some vandalism. There always is. But I think that this will be the responsibility of whether it's the Northwest Steelheaders, the Audubon Society, or whoever. We left it flexible for a reason. Number three, we all work in this process, and we try not to have any surprises. I put together the list, which I mentioned in my previous remarks, including the department, and gave everybody the opportunity to weigh in with notes, with suggestions, with language, including the department, so that we wouldn't have any surprises, because, as you all know, in something that's a pilot project and is relatively simple, we don't want to have anything that slows it down. But this morning, we have found a couple surprises. The language of which was mentioned previously, I believe the department has already weighed in on and then gave me a list of their suggestions, which I ultimately did all the pinning myself, but that's the language that we have today. I think this is wide enough for us to have success, but narrow enough to get at the problem. And lastly, I appreciate the department's general support, but I don't want the department's general support. I want the department's passionate support. There's a difference. Passionate support says, this is okay, we'll manage. I don't want that. I want passionate support. I want the department to help promote this. I want the department to reach out to conservation groups to get this not only started, but also get it working well. That's the purpose of the bill. It's not general support, it's passionate support. So, even though it's Monday morning, it's 9 o'clock, we're all not caffeinated, and Roy, it's hard to be passionate this early in the morning, but that's the nature of the bill. Because if people can work together, we'll get this stuff out of the river.
I'm hearing you. Questions? I was confused a little bit about one small thing. You've been in Alaska. You've seen some of these boxes. I heard that it was just the line and not the lead. Go ahead.
I've seen everything in there. The purpose of this is not to separate line from lead, from split shot, from the occasional fly or hook. The purpose of the bill is just to get it out of the river.
So, off the banks and so on.
Get it out of the river.
Okay. So that was your experience up there. Are there any questions? It is my sense that I'd like to just close the hearing and move to a work session unless somebody has a problem with this bill that I haven't heard about. Oh, you were going to explain. Yes, come on. Keep me awake. I haven't had my caffeine either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think you have two options here. One, I did just go down to fiscal and speak with Judy James regarding Senate Bill 748. Her comment was, yes, she was also questioning the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. She doesn't believe it'll have a minimal fiscal impact, but she was trying to contact the department's fiscal folks to get a confirmation on that. So you could either wait until a little later in this morning's hearing and go to work session then when you have the actual fiscal in front of you. The other option is to take Mr. Elliker's word for it that it is going to have a very small fiscal impact and go ahead and move the bill and request rescinding of the referral. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I think we need to put on the record, if we're going to move this bill out of fiscal, that it would not be general fund dollars that would be used to fund whatever fiscal there would be. And I guess I don't think the microphones can pick up Mr. Elliker's nod of his head.
maybe he'd like to say something verbally.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, if the question is whether or not general funds would be used for any kind of fiscal this might generate, I would say the answer is no.
Okay.
We would use license dollars or sport fishing restoration federal dollars, something very appropriate for this kind of project, pilot program.
Or maybe even R&E dollars.
Very possibly R&E dollars, Mr. Senator Beyer.
Excuse me, acronyms?
The Restoration Enhancement Program.
Thank you.
That's administered by the department, but it is money from a license surcharge and probably would go under the recreational side. Oh, I'm sorry, the Restoration Enhancement Program. So it'll probably be, we'd use a lot of that money in and around fisherman access. So we could just include, in fact, in some of the new fisherman access projects, we might include some of this involved in paperwork like that at some specific locations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? I'd like to just keep these gentlemen here and close the hearing on Senate Bill 748 and move to a work session on Senate Bill 748.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 748 to the floor and ask the President to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee.
So Senator Beyer moves
DuPass recommendation.
Senate Bill 748 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation and rescinds the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion of that? If not, let's call the roll.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. And with that, I'm assuming that Senator Atkinson would like to carry this bill.
He's going to be tied up with a porta potty bill for a couple of days. You might want to defer this to someone that knows what they're doing.
I know it's a little fishy, but we'll let him keep the bill anyway. And with that, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 748 and open, or close the work session and open a hearing on Senate Bill 673.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just don't string us along too much when you carry it on the floor, Senator.
Any more bad puns, and we're going to leadership. We're changing this committee.
Okie dokie. Senate Bill 673. Judith promises no puns during her opening comments.
Judith is not the problem, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Corcoran. Senate Bill 673 allows Oregon seafood harvest cooperatives or associations to negotiate with dealers or negotiate with committees of dealers to establish prices of seafood. It authorizes the director of the Department of Agriculture to supervise negotiations between the cooperatives, the representative committee of dealers, and any Oregon seafood harvester association in establishing the price of seafood, and declares an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no revenue impact. This measure does not have a subsequent referral, but I will point out we have not received a fiscal on this measure yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I'm going to ask Chuck Craig if he'll come up with Brent, is it Seeley? Somebody has really good handwriting. I guess that's also due to a Monday morning situation. Thank you, gentlemen. My apologies for not being able to read that last name.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig with Department of Agriculture. With me is Brent Searle. Mr. Chair, this is not our bill, but we support it. It is an extension of House Bill 3811 that was passed last session, and that bill provided for producers of perennial ryegrass to organize themselves into a cooperative and then bargain with dealers in perennial ryegrass seed. This bill would add seafood to the mix of agricultural commodities for which that is permitted. The reason that the bill is needed is because generally this kind of price-setting activity is not allowed unless a state entity supervises the negotiations so that the parties involved have antitrust immunity. It's been in effect now since the last legislative session for perennial ryegrass bargaining. We've had four rounds of bargaining between the Growers Co-op, which is called the Perennial Ryegrass Bargaining Association, and the dealers. It seems to be working. The cost is minimal. We charge the parties $45 an hour for supervising the negotiations, and then we just bill them all collectively for what it cost in the end.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So, Chuck, can you explain, we just had a problem with the crab fishery, right, where they couldn't agree on the price. Can you explain how that bargaining went and how this would change that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think Brent's quite familiar with that, and I'll give him a shot at it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, for record, Brent Searle. I've been the department's designee for supervising the price negotiations. And, of course, as Mr. Craig said, this has been limited to the ryegrass industry prior to this bill. In the seafood sector and in other sectors, grower cooperatives can pool their resources and propose and negotiate a price, but they can only negotiate with one dealer at a time or one processor. So in the seafood industry,
They have to, as it was described to me by the various commissions, they are calling up and down the coast. They're touching base with different processors and trying to reach some consensus on price, but it's a very time-consuming, very intensive process, and as was evidenced by this year's difficulty in reaching a price, they were unable to get out after the season opened for several weeks. And the intent of this is to be able to get all those dealers in a room together with the co-op under our supervision to try to come up with that price mutually and to circumvent that extended process.
So, Mr. Chair, so is it your view that had this process been in place, that we could have shortened that seven-week period? I mean, I realize you can't predict that with absolute accuracy, but do you think that, that this kind of process would have helped that negotiation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, that's certainly the intent, yes. And I believe it would. We've, as was indicated, had four rounds with the perennial ryegrass folks, and usually those are 4 or 5 hour sessions where we sit down with the parties and they're able to come up with a price, which they recommend to the department, and the director has to sanction or approve that price before it goes into effect. But it certainly coalesced that discussion and focused it very succinctly from what they were doing before. Thank you.
Senator Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, you said that this has been in process since the last session, but the PRBA has been around for quite some time. And so was that just a sunset on it, the last session that passed, or was it in reference to the there was a lawsuit against the PRBA prior to last session when, in fact, the dealers won the lawsuit saying that it was anti-competitive or whatever the issue, you know? Can you respond to that somewhat?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think Brent probably knows more about that than I do. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, prior to the last legislative session, as I described with seafood dealers, PRBA was negotiating individually with every dealer separately. They couldn't meet in a group jointly and do that. So in the same sense that the seafood folks are facing the dilemma they are now, PRBA faced the same dilemma, and it was a protracted, long process. Price discovery was very difficult. And so part of that court settlement was to put together legislation that would create this process for that industry and allow the department to supervise and help with those discussions.
Mr. Chair, I guess the only question, I haven't read the written testimony that someone provided. I guess you guys provided it. What is this generally done to the price of a commodity when you have an association like this or doing the bargaining for all the members of that association?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, in terms of what it would have might have been otherwise, is that the sense of your question? Probably hard to know definitively what the price may have been otherwise. However, the same parties are discussing the price, so you've got PRBA still negotiating for growers and the dealers still representing their interests. They're simply meeting at the same table at the same time, talking about the same issues. I think the process enables a speedier discussion of those items rather than a somewhat convoluted price discovery process. So, again, although it's hard to say definitively, I think based on acreage in production and price marketing signals in the marketplace, I think the prices are pretty close to where they would be otherwise.
Mr. Chair, in a expanding market or a supply and demand situation where the supply is less than the demand, I think I would agree with you, but this is a voluntary association, at least with the PRBA, and hasn't in the past, what happens is when you get a supply and demand situation where the supply is exceeding the demand, you see the growers pull out of the PRBA and selling their product up below PRBA negotiated prices in order to move a commodity.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's a challenge that every cooperative faces in the agriculture arena. I think we've seen many examples in Oregon and around the country where it's to the collective advantage of growers to join in a cooperative and bargain, but there's always perhaps a market signal here and there that may entice some of them out at the fringes, which, you know, can't be prevented. They may do that. It's not unique to this situation. All grower cooperatives face that same dilemma.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's true. I just wanted to get to the point that in an expanding market area, this seems to be a good thing for growers, and even in a declining market, if you can keep growers to stay in it. But from what we saw in the late 90s, or, you know, with ryegrass specifically, when you had an oversupply of ryegrass, we saw pea producers bailing out of the PRBA in order to move their commodity because the PRBA price was set at a price that no one would actually buy it at that price. And I'm just wondering how that would go back to the crab industry, if that, you know, what's going to happen there potentially for the fishermen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, it's hard to predict that kind of thing. I think one of the processes that happened in the PRBA and the ryegrass situation, the negotiated prices sent a signal that lowered the acreage subsequent to those prior years. And of course, as you know, the bankruptcy of ABT was a big factor in all of that as well. This PRBA and the negotiations weren't in isolation. There were other factors happening there that were influencing marketing signals. In terms of how this may play out in the seafood arena, again, you know, our perspective is we're simply providing a forum to bring people together to negotiate. They can bring all the information they have. What happens with, you know, the availability of product, it's somewhat different because in the seafood area you have production controlled by either the National Marine Fisheries Service or Fish and Wildlife setting the harvest limits. And so it's a little more structured environment, and they have a specific window they can get out there, and they have to get on and off. So I think those factors will play into it as well in terms of framing the discussions and the pricing that goes on.
Did you come this morning to do independent testimony or just to answer all the questions that Chuck Craig couldn't answer? Did you have something independent you wanted to
say? I'm just an administrative hack, Mr. Chair. I bring people that know the subject with me.
You're demonstrating that this morning.
Mr. Chair, if I might add one thing to what Brent said, I think that the fact that the organization here provides a better avenue for producers to realize whether they're overproducing or not, and there's at least some hope that if they're involved in an organization and negotiating price, that they will understand that they may be overproducing, and there's a better chance that they'll adjust their production. That certainly has a chance to work in the ryegrass industry in Oregon because of Oregon's position in the seed industry generally. So,
my teasing aside, I do appreciate you bringing the experts along, but I am seriously asking, did you come just to answer questions, or did you have testimony that you were going to give separately?
Mr. Chair, no, I am just trying to respond to questions as best we can.
It's good that you bring valuable resources with you when you come, Chuck. Other questions? If not, let's get Roger Martin up here to talk for a bit and see where we go from there.
Mr. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm the lobbyist for Pacific Seafood, which is probably the largest seafood wholesaler in the state of Oregon, processor and wholesaler. Pacific Seafood is located, headquartered in the city of Portland, but and a new plant is being built, or the offices are being finished now for the new headquarters in Clackamas. We have processing plants in Warrenton, an oyster plant in Tillamook Bay, processing and fish handling facilities in Newport, and down the southern Oregon coast in Northern California in the state of Washington. First of all, we don't have a position on this bill. I wish the Crab Commission person had been here to talk about it, because this is a very complicated subject. We're quite willing to do whatever we can to help. But first, let me give you a brief background, and Senator Corcoran brought up the crab price issue of last December. I wish Terry Thompson, former state representative, could be here, because Terry, as a active fisherman, understands this whole thing.
It's not that bad a crisis that we need Terry Thompson to be here. Okay, we can get it resolved without him in the building. Okay. Believe me, Roger.
Well, I had a discussion with him last week, and he just described for me what the problem was. In his view, part of the problem is created by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who delayed the opening of the crab season last year.
Of course. That's
after December 1st until sometime in mid-December. That resulted in crab being available too late on the market for the Christmas rush. Now, this is Terry's theory. Had they allowed the season to open on December 1st, they would have had enough crab on the market and could have Christmas specials. That's a big selling time. I'm not here to say whether that's right or not, but I would trust his judgment since he's a very experienced person. The whole industry is very sick in Oregon. I don't need to tell you that. It's probably sicker for the fishermen who are located in ports along the Oregon coast, because they don't have as much flexibility. The total fish market is a worldwide market, and Pacific Seafood is actively involved all over the world. We buy in the Orient, we buy in Russia, we buy in Alaska, we buy all over the world, and we sell all over the United States, and perhaps even beyond the borders of the United States. It is a world market, and it's affected by what goes on in other areas. The price, the argument last December had to do with the fact that our, and Pacific Seafood probably buys about 60% of the crab on the Oregon coast. Our price level was $1.25 when the season opened. Infuriated the fishermen. There's a reason the price was there. We had a big supply. This is one of the bumper years for crab. Last year and this year, one of the huge years. If anybody went crabbing, and I went with Terry Thompson last fall, there were more crab in Yaquina Bay than you can believe. The availability of crab is tremendous, and the commercial crabbers were catching it. The price in Alaska all fall was $1.07 a pound in Alaska and in Canada. There was a tremendous amount of crab available. When our season opened, the buyers of crab, the big people in this country, the Krogers, the Safeways, and so forth, didn't need to buy because they had crab on hand, and they knew there was going to be crab available. The market wasn't there. And for that reason, we weren't prepared to pay anymore because we couldn't sell it for anymore. It has since stabilized. I think the price is up to $1.40, $1.50 a pound now. But the timing, all these things had a factor in this. Whether this bill and the setting up of cooperatives can ever solve the problem, I'm not here to say. We have talked to the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission. We're very supportive of them. The opinion of my superiors and the Crab Commission were there are some problems in this bill that need to be worked out, and I can't describe exactly what those problems are. I would encourage you to continue to study this, but I would encourage you also not to pass this bill today until we have a chance to hear both from the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission director, who's a very capable person, and I would like my folks to give their opinion on what the problems are. I can tell you generally we have several problems with the whole idea of it, and part of it is just the government involvement. Pacific Seafood has not had a very good experience with the state of Oregon agencies. I hear in here that I see in testimony that in the preparation of this bill, the Department of Agriculture worked closely with the Attorney General's office. That just gives us a headache. We've had nothing but a bad headache with the experiences with the Attorney General's office over the last couple of years. You also need to know that you're dealing in a very volatile market of people that have tremendous tempers. The crab fishermen can accuse the seafood buyers of all kinds of things, but this is a cyclical kind of thing. This problem happens about every 8 years when there's a tremendous surplus of crab and the fishermen want to get out and go crabbing. There are about two-thirds of crabbers that say, we're not getting a high enough price, we're not going out. And there's always one or two in port say, I got to pay some bills, so I'm going to go out. And boy, the retaliation from the ones that don't want to fish on the guy that does go out is borders on something out of one of the mafia movies. Down in Northern California this fall, there was a horse head found one the next morning after one of the crabbers had gone out on the bow of his boat. We've had tires slashed. We've had all kinds of violence. It's been worse in past years. We had one middle-aged woman in Coos Bay whose son works for Pacific Seafood way down in California. She was threatened because of Pacific Seafood's price. The last time the Attorney General looked into antitrust actions on crabbing, the charges ended up being brought against several fishermen and not any of the buyers. If the existence of this kind of legislation or this kind of commodity commission would help alleviate that, we'd be better off. I can tell you that Governor Kulongoski is actively involved in trying to figure out a way how to get the whole seafood industry in Oregon back on some kind of footing. It's very sick right now. That a lot of that has to do with federal regulations. You remember that if you read about the crab thing, you may remember the publicity of the one fisherman guy who got caught off of Astoria. He was arrested at our dock in Warrenton when he came back, and his entire bottom fish load was confiscated by the federal government. He's been charged with a felony charge of fishing in violated areas. I talked again, referring to former Representative Terry Thompson. He said that fisherman's probably totally innocent. There are two kinds of guidance systems, and the federal government outlined the territory that was a sanctuary, couldn't be fished in, using some kind of navigational guide that the fisherman himself didn't have. He thought he was following the regulations, and he ended up a half a mile inside the zone. The whole area needs a lot of help. The state of Oregon could be helpful if we could get the right kind of mechanism. I'm not sure this is the right kind of mechanism, but I would encourage you to keep actively involved in this, and we'll help where we can, and I think we need to get the Crab Commission involved too. Mr. Chairman, I hope I haven't confused you too much, but again, it's a world market, and we can't control it just from Oregon legislation.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
To recap the testimony, according to Thompson, it's ODF&W and the Fed's fault. That's surprising news.
Yeah.
This bill makes me crabby.
Why don't you clam up then?
Yeah, why don't you clam up, he says.
God, if we're having a Republican Monday now, this is really going to be a troublesome committee.
The shrimp season is presently closed. It opens in about 3 weeks on the 1st of April, and I'll predict for you right now, we're going to have all kinds of shrimp fishermen furious at the price of shrimp, because we have, Pacific Seafood has on ice in storage 4 million tons of shrimp. We overbought last fall trying to keep the fishermen who were bringing it in. We're going to be very chary about buying when the season opens, and I can just hear it now. There's going to be all kinds of collusion. We're failing to do it. There's a huge surplus because shrimp, again, is another item, a little cocktail size shrimp we're talking about. There's been a tremendous amount of them in the ocean, and they've been fished very successfully, and there's an oversupply.
Questions? Thank you, Roger. Appreciate your coming. I'm going to ask Judith to help us out a minute. She may have some thoughts that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some additional information. This bill did come at the request of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission. At the end of last week, I did both email and contact the commission, although Nick Furman, I was not able to reach him directly. I did call information in Coos Bay to try and get a home phone number for him just to make sure he was aware of this, because it makes me nervous when I can't talk to the requester directly. So just that's a bit of information. And also we did receive delivered here this morning a minimal fiscal impact from the fiscal office on this measure. So I wanted to get that on the record too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I know it frustrates us to set up a hearing like this and then not have all the interested parties here. We did post this early enough that we thought everybody would know about it. I'm open to the committee's wishes on the bill, but my sense of it would be to wait a few days, given that the people from the commission aren't here, and in spite of objections by Senator Corcoran, if former Representative Thompson wants to come to my committee, he would be welcome.
Oh, God,
as well.
Careful what you ask, Mr. Chair. That just inordinately lengthens the necessary time to listen to him.
I see. In spite of the sermonizing to my left, I'll hold the bill, give interested parties a chance to come. And so we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 673 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 770. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 770 is sponsored by Senator Bruce Starr. It would, in fact, exempt dairy cattle from brand inspection requirements if those cattle are leaving the state solely for the presentation at recognized livestock shows and accompanied by breed registry documents as well as official health certification. We have received a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to ask Chuck Craig and Roger Huffman to come up, talk with us a little bit. Chuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for the Department of Agriculture. With me is Roger Huffman, who is the administrator of our Animal Health and ID Division. Mr. Chair, we're opposed to Senate Bill 770. The Oregon has had a statewide brand inspection program since 1917, and under that law, all cattle and horses that leave the state have to be brand inspected to verify their ownership. There are three legs to the stool that make the system work. The first is that the law recognizes the brand as the ultimate proof of ownership, and any other documentation of ownership is subordinate to a brand, and that's one of the reasons that brand inspection is so important. Second leg is the acceptance by other states, and third is the fact the law applies to everyone, and there are no loopholes, and this has helped substantially over the years deter livestock theft by denying a market to people in possession of stolen animals. The inspections are not performed only for the benefit of the person receiving the inspection. They're performed for all livestock owners. On the surface, this probably seems like a reasonable and innocuous bill, but our view of it is it's the first hole in the Swiss cheese. There are a number of situations where people could probably with equal justification ask for an exemption, and we really don't want to open the door to that. Some of the unintended consequences we feel of passing this bill would be, one, our law enforcement personnel today have a great deal to do, and their priorities are such that every time you complicate their job, they're less likely to want to do it. And one of our main concerns is that if we create exemptions that require time-consuming evaluation by patrol officers that have stopped a vehicle containing livestock, that they're just really not going to want to spend the time doing that evaluation, when right now they can look at a single document and know whether the person that has the animals is legitimately in possession of them or not. Secondly, other states are not likely to recognize this and may in fact prevent animals from coming back to the state of Oregon under a system like this, because all our surrounding states require a brand inspection prior to animals leaving their state. We created an annual brand inspection certificate specifically for people who frequently move animals back and forth across the border, and those are available, and they do not require a brand inspection on return back into the state from the neighboring state where the animal is originating. If this bill were to pass and you took a dairy cow to Washington and brought it back, you would still have to get a brand inspection in Washington to bring it back. So it really doesn't do all that much for the convenience of the livestock owner. Finally, Mr. Chair, just technically, the exemption in the bill is probably in the wrong place in the law. The law still prohibits the movement of animals out of the state without a brand inspection, even if this bill passed the way it was.
Roger, would you like to share at least the vignette that you shared with me last Friday, I guess it was?
Chairman Shields, Roger Huffman, Administrator, Animal Health and Identification Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. There are many impacts, and we try to keep it to a short page. But there's just a multitude of issues there, and Chuck's mentioned all those. Specifically, I can expand on some of those if you want, but the main thing to consider is that everybody participates, that all states rely on each other's quality of inspection and paperwork as their passport to move, I guess, interstate as well. This creates many problems. In fact, I have spoken to the other states. Washington considered doing something like this, where they would allow their animals, horses and cattle, to come to, for example, the Dallas sale yard without an inspection, because knowing that we would be there inspecting those cattle. Same thing as to possibly go into Idaho. And we simply told them that there would be major problems. Those animals, for instance, could come in to Oregon. Maybe Washington allowed them. Once they got here, we wouldn't know. We don't know what's going on in Washington. We wouldn't know if there was the neighbor's cattle that they brought. We wouldn't have any idea at that time about what the brands are. If they had the same brand in Washington, that they could have that recorded as they have somebody in Oregon has, and then you'd have a conflict, and Oregon would recognize that animal currently as the Oregon registered brand owner's cow, even though somebody came in from Washington with that. So there are issues that, and we have addressed this particular issue many times. The last major time this was discussed is in the late 80s, and there was a Weezer sale yard, which is right across the Snake River. You can actually see it across the bridge. There was an exemption that was asked for, and again, it's like this. Seems to make somewhat of good sense that maybe a little less government, honest people take their things across the border. There's going to be an inspector from Idaho at that sale yard, so they could protect Oregon adequately, and it seemed like maybe that would make good sense. Further evaluation and, again, a discussion with the industry and the folks. It wasn't long before Caldwell called up and also the Napa sale yard and said, hey, we hear there's some consideration for exemptions. We're not that far across the border. We'd certainly like you to consider exempting them to come to our sale yard. And then very quickly after that, we have cattle, as you can imagine, in all places. Walla Walla had a sale yard, Alturas, Cottonwood. We have many cattle that leave the state to sale yards. It looked like we're going to have to make an exemption for everybody going to a sale yard. And then it became, do you want to limit it to 1 mile across the border sale yards, 10 miles, 50 miles? And in the end, it was decided that the only way to make this work and to make it consistent, and also for those states to be able to have comfort that the Oregon brand inspectors that live in the areas close to where those animals are coming from, know best that the animal is or isn't matching a description and maybe the neighbor's cattle. Or that, in other words, that is potentially stolen, and they rely on our documents to come with the cattle, and they put great faith in that. And if people were allowed to move, that seriously would cause problems. They would get there, then that state wouldn't have anything to clear them with to come back, and so. Like I say, it seems like a fairly simple deal. And I guess the only other thing I'd touch on is the cost. The cost for somebody that wants to go to a fair with an animal in Oregon, take your dairy animal, it's 75 cents per head for this inspection that we come out and perform. That's the actual cost to the producer to do it if you want to do it one time. Again, Chuck mentioned the other option is you can get an annual. And all the states have agreed to accept that. And so they don't have to get one leaving Oregon or coming back to Oregon, leaving other states, in other words. And that's $5 per animal for a calendar year. We estimated in the fiscal that potentially, at a very maximum, we're talking about 200 head that this impact would be on real people that were doing this activity. The real issue for me and the quality of our program is I know, and I certainly wouldn't put these names on the record, but I knew many people that deal in dairy cattle that would take advantage of this and certainly could easily say to any law enforcement or somebody that wasn't experienced in when they're encountering these animals. That would have lots of paperwork in their jockey box. They know what the exemptions are and what they are, and it would certainly be an easy way to move cattle. I think be taken advantage of, in other words.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What's the process that a 4-H student, an RFFA student, has a Jersey cow or her Jersey heifer she wants to, he or she, shouldn't be sexist on this, wants to take that heifer to a show in Washington. What's their process for getting this brand inspection, either the $0.75 per trip or the $5 annual fee? What do they need to do?
Chairman Shields, Senator Beyer, what they would do is they would call an inspector, which we have. I believe right now there's 67 part-time and 5 full-time around the state. They're supervisors, and it also deal field work. They would call the local person, closest person to them, and that person, the brand inspector, would go out physically, look at the animals, all of that identification, both sides of the animal, because the locations we're looking for that brands would be as the neck, shoulder, rib, and hip. And look at all the identification on the animal, both sides, and also they have a stolen lost animal sheet. They would look at that to make sure that the animal they're looking at doesn't match that description of those missing in other states and also reported missing in Oregon. Then, after, if they're satisfied, they would issue, if you were going to go just to one time, to one show, they would issue a certificate that described that animal, showed you as the owner and the destination of where you're going. They would, and what we've done is to, so all states agree, it would be a blue certificate for movement. And if the if we had to travel out there specifically to only do that one animal, so that we're not making it misleading in any way, there's a $10 service charge travel fee. So when we left there, if you wanted to do that, it would cost you $10.75 to get that paper to go to Washington. If you did that, you'd then have to call a Washington inspector to come out and look at it for you to travel back to Oregon. So it would cost you, right now it's 60 cents for their charge per head, and they're potentially going up to 85 cents with current legislative action. Or if you were going to do it again for the calendar year, like, and we have the same thing for horses, we would issue a certificate that had a has a picture of a cow on it. We would put all the markings of that animal, individual animal, on that blue piece of paper, and you would use that for traveling back and forth. And that would be $5 for that animal, plus a $10 service charge if you just had one. It's a one-time $10 charge to go out there.
One more question, Senator Vine. Are dairy cattle typically branded?
Chairman Shields, Senator Beyer, typically I would say, I guess if you was to look at them going through the local auction yard, I'd say about 5 to 10% on any given day actually will have brands. Now on the east side, they are almost all branded, but on the west side here, very few are. But some of the big ones, like Mallory's Dairy, as you guys are all familiar with here, every one of their animals has at least one brand. Usually they have two, because they have a theft problem when they're born from some of their employees oftentimes. So they will put a brand on them immediately after they're born. And then when they get larger, then they'll put a, what they're putting a hair brand on first, which isn't real. So it isn't real. It's identifiable and it's a deterrent, but it isn't a real good one. And then and when it gets a little bit larger, they'll put the same brand a little larger up on the location. So, for example, they are Rick Rail Dairy out here, which is another large one, used to brand all of their animals because they were moving them to California and growing them out. So it depends. There's a mix. But if they're going out on open range or moving interstate, yes, they're branded because they want to get their animals back.
Any other questions? If not, I'd like to get Cynthia from the Oregon State Police up to talk about the issue from their perspective. And if you don't mind, I'm going to ask Glenn Stonebrink if he'll come up too, just to keep things moving along here.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one thing. It is possible for someone to avoid this service fee by taking their animal to the brand inspector, if that's more convenient. So.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate you doing that. Senator Corcoran, you had a comment?
Nope.
Okay. Welcome, Cynthia. Glad you're here.
Good morning, Senator Shields, members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Koch. I'm the director of the Fish and Wildlife Division for the Oregon State Police. Excuse me. I'm here today at the request of the Department of Ag. We're here to support their opposition to this bill. If they were up here right now, I'd probably say, as my testimony, what they said, because I thought they made a great case for enforcement. They spoke about all of the issues. Our officers, both patrol and Fish and Wildlife, are trained by the Department of Ag in livestock inspection. And at this time, they know that there are not any exemptions, and so wouldn't be looking for that. They're looking for the same document generally every time they make a stop. This isn't a high priority kind of enforcement that the Oregon State Police is involved in. I took a look at our statistics and saw that I think in 2002 up until November, I think we did 24 livestock checks. What we recognize with this exemption is that it does open the door for a rather unscrupulous person to do something that was the exemption was well-meaning for, but certainly could do something illegally and start moving cattle under this exemption, in fact, be doing something unlawful.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. Glenn?
Is she referring to Denny Jones or Ben Lundquist?
You choose. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Sonbrake. I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen Association, and I know that you all like short testimonies, especially Senator Corcoran. So everything's been covered pretty well. Our system works, our cattlemen pay for it, and we would not like to see it diminished. Please defeat the bill.
Thank you.
Sonbrake, can I finally agree on something?
Amazing. Any questions? I'm not going to ask for any wise guy comments, just questions.
I'm wondering why we have this bill. I haven't heard anybody in favor of it yet.
It's kind of fascinating. I'm not going to detail that for you in committee, but if you want to talk about it later, we will. Glenn Addington from the Farm Bureau. Oh, Craig, excuse me. I jumped from Glenn's name down to your last name, and my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Greg Addington, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't know if I'm allowed to just say ditto up here, but I think it's all been said. We think that the bill creates more problems than it helps solve, and creates a loophole where we currently don't have one, so we would ask you to oppose the bill as well.
Thank you. Let me, since I made a comment that I probably shouldn't have made to Senator Corcoran, be clear. We scheduled this bill because it was sponsored by a prominent senator who we all respect. He chose not to...
From the city?
No. Well, kind of. But he chose not to testify on it. The requester of the bill, they were unable to get a hold of. It's not my intention to do anything with the bill at this point, especially once Roger educated us last week on the bill. So we're probably not going to do anything with it. I always plan on having open hearings on bills, especially if a credible person brings them to us. But I think the Christmas tree farmer and I are not real knowledgeable about the subject, and so with apologies, we will probably not move this bill any farther unless I hear from some senators upstairs that they want to do so. So with that, I'm just going to adjourn the committee.